The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kwiatkowski. This has been a momentous and tumultuous week in the news, and the technological fallout of the events in Egypt are part of this week's program. We'll be bringing you the latest on the government's decision to shut down the internet in that country and what this means for global revolutionaries. We'll also be hearing more on the Indian social media trends in the second of our interviews from the India Social Summit last month.
India is an extremely robust democracy, and I think democracy is the foundation of social media, where you allow people to voice their voices freely, social media takes root. That's probably a very strong reason why social media is flourishing in India. Right? People love to speak, and India lets them speak. Social media enables that. One voice can connect with another, and I think that fundamentally is very powerful.
Wise words in light of current events in Egypt. We'll have more on that later. We'll also shine a spotlight on the next Y2K meltdown, the beginning of the shift from IPv4 to IPv6 in the coming months means that many of your web services will cease to function unless you take technological precautions. Joining me to discuss these headline stories and the rest of this week's news are Charles and Jemima. Welcome.
Well, hello.
Oh, at once we have a little chorus going on, don't we?
Oh.
Yes, indeed. Charles, were you at the Facebook announcement this week in The Guardian?
Indeed, I wasn't.
Indeed, you weren't. But Jemima, you're waving around like you just don't care.
I was. It was quite a high profile, quite big, flashy event with stages and cameras and all sorts. They went great guns on that. But it's a key pillar of their commercial strategy for the future.
What is the key pillar? What is it that they
The key
announced?
Pillar is Facebook Deals. So if you use Facebook app on your iPhone or on Android or on Facebook.com on your mobile, you can log into a venue on Places. And if it's got a kind of Willy Wonka-esque golden ticket next to the name, there'll be a deal there, like a discount, or you can group buy with friends and get money off.
Well, if you're curious about the junction between news gathering, reporting, and technology, we're profiling the Guardian Hack South by Southwest project, feeding you nuggets of what to expect from the event in London in a few weeks' time, and the interactive conference in Austin, Texas in March. Keep listening for 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We start with this week's news. The riots in Egypt over the past week have been revolutionary. Political upheaval on the streets have overwhelmed the authorities, and the fragile new cabinet have sought to retain control over an increasingly vocal and mobilized audience. However, since Saturday, the country's internet access has been 80% dark, with ISPs mysteriously taking their network activity offline at the behest of the government. Earlier in the crisis, President Mubarak closed down access to social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, recognizing the network technology's role in connecting insurgents and protesters to collaborate on protest actions during other public movements, like the recent activity in Tunisia. But eliminating access to the internet completely is unprecedented. A few weeks ago, Charles Arthur spoke with Evgeny Morozov, author and cyber activism expert during the Tunisian protests. Evgeny had this to say about the power of the web for social action.
I was never skeptical about the power of new media and social media to mobilize protest. You can use, you know, Facebook and Twitter and any other tools to mobilize people to do something that they wouldn't do otherwise. The question is whether that actually happened in Tunisia is an open one, whether any of the same people would actually show up as angry as they were if there was no Twitter or Facebook. I probably assume that social media did help to mobilize some people. I also think that it did play an important role in terms of highlighting what was going on and then transmitting it to some of the global media like Al Jazeera. So all of that definitely is happening. Belarus actually is a very good example of how technology and mobile phones can actually be used against activists. So now there are some reports that after the protests following the presidential elections on December 19th, the government may actually be asking mobile operators for any data that they have on their subscribers to track down everyone who was present in the public square where the protests were happening.
As Evgeny said, the phone systems can also be used by authorities to track protesters. Now, this is particularly interesting in light of the latest release from Google via an acquired service called Say Now and in partnership with Twitter. Google announced on their blog in the last 24 hours that they were implementing Speak to Tweet, a way for people to send tweets without internet access by phoning an international number. Here's one that came in earlier.
Together بعد صلاة الظهر في اسكندرية. There is a demonstration will start in City Gather after Zohr prayer.
That was an anonymous Arabic protester who phoned in their tweet to Google Speak to Tweet service. Charles, how did the authorities actually cut the net off completely?
Well, our understanding, because actually this hasn't come out and none of the people involved with any of the ISPs has told us, but it seems that they changed the routing information. Looking at ripe.net, which is the European and Middle East sort of routing internet table system, the BGP routers, which basically tell signals, you know, internet packets where to go, were instructed not to let stuff go in or out of Egypt. So it's a sort of software fix, basically. Rather than pulling plugs out of the wall, they just did a few things on the screen. And that seems to have just, basically it kills the internet. It means that you can send stuff in to Egypt, but there's no response from the router, so you don't know if the packets have ever reached it. You can try to send stuff out, but again, the routing table just doesn't allow a path through, and so nothing happens.
But surely there must be a workaround. I mean, there must be sort of dark web elements. There must be rogue networking agents somewhere within the system that allows this path to communicate, because ultimately that's the point of a network like the internet.
There were
distributed
stories that people were digging up old dial-up modems, actually, so they've been trying to find alternative methods of getting online.
Yeah, though, of course, your problem with the dial-up modem is still you have to dial into a modem somewhere else, so you're probably going to be making an international call. And although, as far as we know, international calls did work. The problem that happened here is a bit unusual. I spoke to James Blessing of ISPA, who was saying that Egypt is unusual in as much as there are very few points where the internet crosses, internet cables cross out of the country. So there's just a few at the junction with Israel. There's a few going across the sea towards Italy. Perhaps you've got a few going over towards sort of Iran or Iraq sort of area. And once you cut those off, you're done. Whereas if you tried to cut off the UK, or if you tried to do that with a similar country, if you tried to do it with the US, there are simply so many points that the mesh is too complicated for you ever to cut it off.
There was an incident not too long ago, was there not, with the one of the pipes, as it were, that went into Egypt a couple of years ago, where they also similarly had trouble, didn't they?
It was a ship dropped.
A transatlantic cable got severed, or a transoceanic cable got severed by a passing ship as it was coming into harbour. Yes.
Now, but that was an accident. That was clearly a physical.
It's an accident. And it reduces the traffic. It just makes it harder to go. I mean, I've heard stories about people in Australia when they've been. Some situations where an internet packet will have travelled the whole of the distance, the long way around the world, to get from one side of Australia to the other.
Tenacious.
Simply because that's the way that the internet sort of routes it. It's actually the simpler route. It can happen. It's just as a country gets more and more internet bound, as you get more points crossing the borders, there are more routes and it becomes harder for the government to cut it off.
Jemima, what are the Egyptian authorities' relationship with the internet in the past? Have they been very censorious? So have they cut things off?
Well, it's one of the least restrictive countries in the Middle East, and they've actively encouraged industry and telecommunications as a real unique selling point, if you like, for Egyptian industry. That said, they are listed as one of the 12 worst countries in the world as an internet enemy by Reporters Against Borders. And they've been doing things like allegedly surveillance of dissidents online and victimization of bloggers who've been writing things against the government. So a very mixed picture there.
Now, the UN has established that access to information via the internet or other means is a basic human right. So how is an organization, an international organization like the UN, responding to this situation in Egypt?
Not very much, actually, because I think there's more pressing things going on in Egypt. Rather, it's not as if the government has suddenly said, well, we're not going to have any more internet, and nothing else is going on. You know, there are people on the streets in Egypt. It's, there are more pressing matters to be dealt with.
I was actually trying to do some research on this, and I couldn't actually get through to the UN's Egyptian internet pages. So, you know, weave your conspiracy theory into that, if you like. But I was also talking to Paul Hamalos, who's one of our deputy news editors, and he's been dealing with a lot of the copy that our reporter in Egypt has been filing. And it's a side story is that the way we've been covering this event, because there has been no internet and only intermittent mobile coverage, is they've literally had to fax copy to him because he wasn't able to get onto the wires. He wasn't able to even see basic agency copy and find out what was going on because he had no internet. He couldn't read other reports of where and what was happening. So he's had to read some updates, go onto the streets even more than he was already, piece the things together, piece the reports together, and then fax them back to the office. And they've then had to be put together by a typist at our end.
Steam-powered like journalism.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't
but
it?
He said working in a vacuum was actually a really constructive thing because you don't get distracted or overwhelmed by the amount of coverage that's out there, and you just get out there and talk to more people.
Does that, arguably, that is potentially dangerous as well, because you would only then have access to the immediate information as opposed to almost a global perspective or even a national perspective?
But a lot of news organisations go in there with the agenda predetermined. This is what we think of the protest and this is how we're going to cover it, and they just seek out people to reinforce that.
Clearly not The Guardian, and especially not in this situation.
Definitely
because we
not.
Can't. We don't have the ability. Well, actually, that raises an interesting question. How have journalists been able to tweet and all of these other things? Is it now, it's the speak, the speak now implementation, the speak to tweet.
Say now.
Now.
Thank you.
It's a bit like audio boo, effectively, yeah. But you can call your message in, and you can do that from a landline as well, and it will tweet a link to that post on Twitter. So that's a really clever workaround.
So given that there are potentially rogue networks, the internet is not completely cut off in Egypt.
There's still sat phones. I guess if you have sort of an Inmarsat sat phone, then you could basically you just punch up to the through the atmosphere and, hey, there you are. You've got some internet.
What kinds of dangers are the people who are connecting to the satellite technologies putting themselves in, the protesters who are trying to access these rogue networks?
I'm not sure that there's any particular danger there, actually, because, I mean, if you're using a sat phone, you're pretty much undetectable. And again, as I say, the government's got bigger, the government there has bigger things to worry about. The entire cabinet resigned the other day. The army has said that it's not going to take any action against the protesters. So I think really that, perhaps a while ago, it would have made a bigger difference. I think that actually one of the sort of core celebres that made Twitter become noticed internationally was when someone was arrested in Egypt and tweeted, "They're arresting me." So that's the sort of thing where, yes, you know, the internet played a big part there. But I think actually things are moving past, you know, the stage where we'd say, oh, the internet's making a difference. The internet's not making any difference now. It's real old-fashioned, you know, people talking to each other, banging on doors.
Yeah, word of mouth. The ultimate social network.
Indeed. Very between social people.
Well, there's a big article on that by Cory Doctorow in the paper from last week, and we will keep you updated in future podcasts. But for up-to-the-minute coverage of the events in Egypt, go to guardian.co.uk. Over the next 18 months, the internet's reserves will run out. Internet Protocol version 4's address allocation is being exhausted, and soon, as new online websites and other services begin to use the addresses allocated by its successor, IPv6, old sites won't work. It's kind of the equivalent, Charles, you explained to me, of the internet's oil wells running out and everyone having to move to fusion power. I like that. That's
the nice thing is we've actually got fusion power on the internet.
Well, good. We can see the little atoms squishing together. Squishing, that's the technical term. The last address blocks on IPv4 were allocated this week, and experts expect a real crunch time in about 18 months when there will be none. Old systems will not be able to get to some sites. You'll click, but you won't be able to see a site with an IPv6 address. So here to talk us through the impending obsolescence of the current system is James Blessing from the UK Internet Services Providers Association. He's on the line now. James, what is the situation? Will we no longer be able to access sites?
This is one of those great questions of yes and no and maybe, depending on various things. IPv4 and IPv6 will work alongside each other beautifully well if implemented perfectly. If not implemented perfectly, they don't really like each other because they're not compatible. They just happen to share the same bit of internet space.
When it comes to me using the internet, I don't know if I'm on IPv4 or IPv6. I don't know. What will happen to me? What equipment will be affected? My Windows XP computer, routers, ISPs. What will happen when I go onto a system?
Right. If you've got the latest and greatest software on your laptop, so you're running Windows 7, you're running OS X, you're running a decent Linux distribution that's reasonably up to date, then your laptop will be fine, not a problem. Your router in the corner of the room probably doesn't have a hope of running V6 today. If you're running in a business, then your nice Cisco expensive router in the corner or your nice Juniper router in the corner will be working fine. But if you've got a cheap domestic class or pro, you know, consumer router, it's unlikely to have any IPv6 support whatsoever.
And that's quite condemning, isn't it? Does that mean though, then I will lose my access to the web?
You'll still get everything that's there today. You'll still be able to get to. It's the new stuff. It's any new company that wants to launch a fantastic website, unless they can get IPv4 space from somebody else, will have to launch on IPv6 only. And that will leave you in the situation where only those people who can get to IPv6 can get to it. Now, it's not as bad as I'm making out. I really am being a pessimist to some extent. If you've got a cable router in the States, Comcast have, in the last couple of days, just started enabling IPv6.
This is a phenomenon that I imagine is going to exponentially become problematic. How long, for example, did it take IPv4 to allocate all of its addresses, and how long, you know, how long is IPv6? At what point are we going to end up with another issue like this?
Well, this is the best bit about IPv6. IPv6 has enough address space to give everybody in the world today their own internet, if you really wanted to. So there's plenty of address space in IPv6. In IPv4, IPv4 is late 70s technology. In 1999, the first allocation of address space in IPv6 was made. So we have been prepared for this for a long time, and we have done a lot of work. Most of the big networks around the world, and quite a few of the smaller networks around the world, are ready. They have got IPv6 running in their networks. The problem keeps falling down on a couple of things. The one that kills us most is the consumer equipment at home. It needs replacing.
Well, thank you very much, James. You can find out more on both these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. A few weeks ago, we heard from Nikhil Pawa from Nama.com, who offered an overview of the Indian web scene. This week, our India coverage continues with a look at the rapidly expanding social media landscape. The India Social Summit in Delhi in December was a gathering of several hundred bloggers and corporate heads from Facebook India to Google India, looking at the emergence of social media as a powerful tool for branding organizations. Now, this is a country that dominates both Facebook and Google's Orkut site, and whose population is increasingly developing an enormous Twitter presence. At the conference, the organizers presented the second empirical report on the social scene, and I spoke with the organizer of the conference and report author, Rajesh Lalwani of Blogworks, and Kartik Nagarajan from Nielsen Online India. Rajesh began telling me where the idea for the event came from.
We conceived this property about a year ago, and the idea was very simply to create an environment where different stakeholders could engage with each other. So we said, okay, we're going to do a big event in Delhi where people could come together, get to meet with each other, close business deals, find potential partners, and many different kinds of relationships of the business kind could be seeded.
Would this be the best place, or rather, how would you sell India as the best place to set up a foreign office for a global company?
Well, we are a billion plus people. I think that's a good enough reason to set up an office if you're a marketer. India is also emerging a very key component of the knowledge economy. A lot of the back-end operations are now driven or centered or focused around knowledge, and I think that's a very we are the largest English speaking country in the world, and that helps for any large multinational that's planning to use India as the hub. We're also now emerging as a very strong manufacturing hub for a lot of products, particularly automobiles and so on and so forth. So I think in that sense, from many different perspectives, if you were to ask, India has the opportunity of being the Asia hub pretty much on the lines that Hong Kong is, except Hong Kong as a small island is more a meeting hub, whereas India could be not just a meeting but also a delivery hub.
What is happening in India that is encouraging the development of social media and digital content?
I think India is an extremely robust democracy, and I think democracy is the foundation of social media, right? So where you allow people to voice their voices freely, social media takes root. So I think that's probably a very strong reason why social media is flourishing as it is in India. Right? People love to speak, and India lets them speak. Social media enables that. One voice can connect with another, and I think that fundamentally is very powerful.
Are there any grassroots, homegrown social media enterprises that are particularly significant, or do you think that it's outside organizations, things like Facebook or other types of facilities that are popular in this country?
Social has come at a time where internet itself is just about to explode in India. Unlike other markets where online has been around for like a couple of decades and then social came after. And also, India is very big on relationships, interpersonal relationships. So I think all this put together makes social extremely special.
There is a very different ecosystem of mobile social networking sites or mobile social networking platforms that exist. So for example, there is a homegrown product called RockerTalk, right, which is doing extremely good business. What RockerTalk does is allows people to network with each other from mobile to mobile. Now, I'm not saying use the mobile to consume Facebook, but mobile to mobile. Now, that's a completely different economy where local geography and the flavor of that local geography has more relevance than a connections network of the nature of Facebook. That's where I think a lot of the Indian brands are making this presence well.
As far as India is concerned, the next big thing is mobile. There's no doubt about that. It's and the best part is it's something that no one has tapped yet because it's in the process of evolving. There are no experts in that business. There are no successes yet because the target is moving. So that obviously is attracting tremendous amount of interest. And social media is not a distant second in that space as well. There's a lot of buzz about what's possible in India with social media.
So do you feel that people who are investing in this space and, in fact, the future of the development in India should remain or will remain within its boundaries? Or do you think that the Indian development scene is still looking outside as if to win outside interests in the application?
Our belief, my belief at least, is that we have so far focused on back-end operations for large multinational companies. We had a cost advantage, we had an English advantage. Having said that, those two advantages are not going to remain ours forever. Countries like China, countries like Philippines are working hard to match India in terms of costs. So where we are now beginning to feel an impact is that our costs are no longer as low as they were. The wages are increasing, payments are not keeping pace with that. Clients are also becoming far smarter, and they now know how and what they can pay in respective different markets. So in such a scenario, the logical next step would be for India to get into product development. So my belief is that you will see potentially some blockbuster wins in terms of products coming out of India. So I would give it probably a timeline of 2 years, 3 years, and so on and so forth.
My last question then is looking more socially, looking at the digital media space, do you see the social networking phenomenon, the social software phenomenon, as having a significant effect on the Indian cultural society?
I think today, when someone wakes up, right, in India, if a teenager wakes up in India, or someone in the 20 to 30 year old wakes up in India, he's setting aside some time to log on to social network, right? This is new. Now, what can you do with it, or what does this person do online when he's doing this? That's the next question. Culturally, I think it's going to have that kind of an impact. So a lot of people are going to be able to communicate better. A lot of people are going to come together for many different causes. But it might not really change the fabric, because that's more, it's more deeply ingrained. So I don't see it changing the fabric of the Indian culture overnight or in the next 10 years. But I think it's certainly going to change the way we communicate with friends and family. What kind of change will happen in India is anybody's guess. I think it's definitely changing the way people react to the government, the way communication, political and social, is changing.
Rajesh Lalwani and Kartik Nagarajan at the India Social Summit last month. India, like China, is an important powerhouse in the digital media space, but it's interesting. Having been in Taiwan a few weeks before I went to India, I've really felt that the relationship with the world's new media in these two regions is very different from one another. So China, for example, tends to create its own Facebook, its own Twitter, its own LinkedIn. It's got its own Google. It's very sort of isolationist. It says, we're going to do it ourselves. Whereas Indian users are not just happy to, but actively embrace the existing social media technologies and, you know, are active in trying to join things like Facebook and Twitter. So, Charles, how do you think that this is going to affect their position in the global market, the Indian development scene's position?
Well, I guess it gives them much better access. I mean, Silicon Valley has lots of people from India who have gone over there to, you know, find fame and fortune. There are plenty of people in Britain who have, the sort of old colonial link, I guess. It's got a renown as a country which is very accessible, very integrated with the world. Whereas China, I think, is still seen as being more secretive because, as you said, it prefers to do things its own way. It doesn't sort of join bandwagons. It says, nice looking bandwagon over there. I think we'll build one that looks just like it.
To what extent do you think, though, that it's important for countries and the global web ecosystem, Jemima, to create their own social media solutions, as it were?
It's enormously important. It's not only important for the industry to support local talent and give them a system by which they can invest their own time and talent into something that benefits that country and that economy, but also developing a domestic system gives you the chance to exploit much more nuanced elements of a culture, certain subtleties about the way people interact with each other or what they want to share. We know that that emailing is massive in Japan and they're not really that bothered about text messaging, but there are much more subtle differences between different continents and different countries that are really important. Rocket Talk was mentioned, actually. That's a very interesting case in point because it's specifically a mobile social network and it's mostly used for video. They can do all sorts of things, but the video is really popular on that. And it's got 4.5 million monthly users, which doesn't sound like a huge number, but India's internet use is at about, as of August last year, it was at about 13 million, which isn't huge, but look at the total population of 1.1 billion and the potential for growth there is likely to be in mobile. So massive, massive potential there.
Without a doubt. And I think that some of the initiatives within the Indian government for non-smartphone mobile access, getting that out to the rural areas and how much of a connection that's allowing people does facilitate and encourage the use of mobile social networks like Rocket Talk. We have an interview with Rocket Talk that will be in a future podcast. But Charles, tell me a little bit more about the mobile trends in India and how that may ultimately reflect back on how we use mobile social networks. Or do you even think that a mobile social network would come over here?
There sort of is one already. It's called Twitter. In India is sort of a region almost unto itself in the way that it uses mobile. You have things over there such as dual SIM phones, which people will use if they're near a border between the different regions, because you'll get one provider in one place, one and another in another, and you might go with one phone number in one place and a different one. So you get these sort of strange beasts. And Nokia, for example, lost lost some market share last year because it wasn't able to come up with dual SIM phones fast enough. The smartphone business is exploding over there. And standard feature phones are very widely used. It's all used for mobile banking as well. Not the sort of thing that you think about, but text message banking, which is very effective. So actually, the fact that you can deploy mobile phones and mobile phone networks so much quicker than if you're laying landlines means that, yes, a lot of these remote villages out in Indian farmlands will have mobile far before they get any other sorts of modern cons, if you like, such as computers and landline-based broadband.
There was a great question in from Duncan Watkins on Twitter, who actually had a great question in last week as well. Given the Indian government's hardball actions on RIM this week, RIM who make the BlackBerry, how ready are they to accept uncontrolled social media? Charles?
Well, just to clarify on the RIM thing, the Indian government gave RIM a deadline of January the 31st, which passed on Monday night, to give them access to all emails and messenger messages, including those sent to and from corporate BlackBerries. And RIM said that it could do it on pretty much everything else, but not the corporate ones, because those use private encryption keys to which it has no access. Now, it's not clear whether the Indian government has accepted this. There's been nothing as we speak on Tuesday, and it's well into Tuesday for the Indian government. No indication of what action, if any, it's going to take against RIM. The concern that the Indian government clearly had was about people transmitting messages which it couldn't see at all. It's not about mobile social networks or even, standard social networks. It's really about people sending encrypted messages that it has no way of tapping into. So I suspect that it's less worried by uncontrolled social media. Rather like with Egypt, where, the Egyptian government was able to monitor what people were doing, as Evgeny Morozov has pointed out. It's a great way for governments to want to monitor people. That's not the concern. It was much more about encrypted communications between people who they think could be terrorists. There's some indication that Pakistan is going to take the same measures against RIM. It's not clear again where that's going to end up.
More on the Indian web over the next few weeks as we continue our coverage of the social media scene in that country. Now, before we leave you for this week, there are two events happening at Guardian Towers in February. As we mentioned last week, the Guardian's Games Blog is hosting the very first Games Blog live event with the key players behind EA's forthcoming releases, Crysis 2, Shift 2, and Dragon Age 2. Lots of twos. Keith Stewart, who is the Guardian's games correspondent, will be hosting the day, and he will be grilling the developers about storytelling in games, the art and design behind the big hitters, and all kinds of cool things about narrative and technology. So find out more at guardian.co.uk/gamesblog. But as we mentioned last week, Jemima, you've been hard at work organizing Guardian Hack South by Southwest, tell me about it. It's an event bringing journalists and geeks together in a happy love-in.
Well, the starting point was that we wanted to create a bit of time and space to play with some new stuff. If we're going to go and try and cover an event in new ways, how could we do that? And what kind of alternative ways of covering an event would people like to see? South by seemed an ideal candidate because it's about technology, it's about music, and it's about film, and the audience there has a big appetite. But it's not just about South by, it's just about doing interesting stuff. The really interesting thing is that we've got a really unusual mix of people coming along to this. So there will be lots of developers there from all sorts of places. There'll be some guys from Media Molecule, the Little Big Planet team, coming along. We've got some guys from Spotify, and many others. But we've also got Le Monde, the French newspaper, La Repubblica, the Italian newspaper, and Edda Media from Norway. So really interesting input and hopefully really interesting output.
We've spoken about this a little bit with Joy Ito, who was head of Creative Commons. He was saying that there's an interesting trend in Europe and New York, for example, that suddenly it seems that because the tech is accessible, Silicon Valley, that's where the developers have been. But now it seems that some of the really interesting ideas are coming out of London and New York or various other places in Europe and New York because
creatives, journalists, other types of people who don't necessarily have the tech abilities can come up with ideas and then can use a lot of the tech that's come out of Silicon Valley as well. So is this exploiting that idea? Is this saying, here you go, journalists who want to be developers?
We would say that, but it's not just about those geographical territories. It's about those kind of industry territories, I suppose. And what happens if you get games pump companies and hardcore music fans and newspapers? What happens when they all try working on hacks to, kind of playing around with their data? And what would the journalism look like? Would it mean? I mean, we were talking about ideas like, obviously, you could sort of introduce playlists to things, which could get very interesting. But what about Wordle for video? Is that possible? What would that look like? What kind of visual navigation would you come up with? What about tools for collaboration or curating content from across the web and then building them into some system where somebody with editorial expertise could kind of refine that as a package, as an offering? There are so many things you could explore. It's going to be dead exciting.
And this is specifically for people to cover South by Southwest, isn't there? Because there's a prize
element. Well, yes and no. I mean, it's broader than that. We have been quite emphatic in that this is an open collaboration project. So, you know, if the Times wants to come in and use some of these hacks to cover the tennis, then great. It's just we think South By is a good event to start with. But this is about innovating and trying and experimenting and just see what works. Probably loads of them won't work that well, but eventually we'll have a toolbox of stuff that we could use for Glastonbury, for the Olympics, all sorts.
So that's big blue sky idea. What's actually going to happen when I turn up on the day? I'll be there.
We're going to build cool shit. That's what's going to happen.
Well, we will also be featuring the Guardian Hack South by Southwest event here on Tech Weekly, because both Jemima and I will be wandering around shoving microphones in people's faces. Please don't run away from us when you see us, because we do want to talk to you. That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be doing teledildonics. That's right. We're going to be talking about sex, baby. And that's because at the end of this week, the column, the Untangling the Web column in The Observer is all about how the web has transformed sex.
You're such an old romantic, Alex.
I'm just cynical. Anyway, for now, many thanks to Charles and Jemima and also to James Blessing. I'm Alex Kratosky. I am cynical. And this week's podcast was produced by Scott Colley. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.